Last week we were discussing Roman 1, and we were down to F. Roman 1 is general remarks about prophetism in ancient Israel. And in section F, we were talking about the bands or companies of prophets that are referred to in the Old Testament. We had looked at some of those references under F1, and I had just introduced F2. Members of these companies came to be called sons of the prophets, B'nai and Nevi'im. And I think I mentioned right at the end of the hour, sons there, it certainly doesn't mean children of the prophets. The term son in Hebrew sometimes means male descendant, sometimes it means a longer-term descendant. Jesus Christ, son of Abraham, son of David. It also can mean member of the group. And I think it's under that last meaning that we should understand this expression, sons of the prophets. I want to give you a couple illustrations of that usage of the term son. If you look at Nehemiah 12:28, you read there, I'm reading from the NIV. The NIV translates 12:28, the singers also were brought together from the region around Jerusalem, from the village of the Netophalites, and so on. But the singers, if you look at the Hebrew text, it's what you have there on the overhead. It's B'nai and Mishorim. It's sons of the singers. It seems in the context quite clearly the reference there is to members of the choir, the people that belong to a certain group, the singers. So I think the NIV has translated that correctly, the singers, not the sons of the singers. If you look at Psalm 18:45, 44 in the English translation, the NIV says for Psalm 18:44, as soon as they hear me, they obey me. And then the next word, foreigners cringe before me. Foreigners cringe before me. Foreigners are strangers. The Hebrew is B'nai Niftar, sons of strangers. It's not the children of the strangers or the children of the foreigners who cringe before me. It's those who belong to that category or group. Foreigners cringe before me. They all lose heart. They come trembling from their stronghold. You see, 43 is said, people I did not know are subject to me. As soon as they hear me, they obey me. Foreigners cringe before me. If you look at Psalm 72:4, now here's an interesting situation because you get into an interpretive question. NIV translates Psalm 72:4, he, that is the Lord, will defend the afflicted among the people. Oh no, it's not the Lord, it's the king. Thou the king with your justice, O God. He will judge your people, so forth. He will defend the afflicted among the people. But then the next phrase in the NIV says, and save the children of the needy. The Hebrew there is L'bnei Evyon, the children of the needy. Now, NIV here has translated it, children of the needy. In other words, the king will defend the afflicted among the people. He will save the children of the needy. He will crush the oppressor. Well, now, what's proper translation there? Is the king going to save the children of the needy? Or is he going to save the needy? For the children of the needy, the people who belong to that category of people, the needy. If you look at the parallelism, you see the first phrase is, he will defend the afflicted among the people. And it seems to me, on the basis of the parallelism, it would be justified here to conclude he will defend the afflicted among the people and save the needy. Not the children of the needy, the needy themselves. But you could debate that. NIV, New American Standard, and King James all translate children of the needy. The Revised Standard Version translates it needy. He will save the needy. Jewish Publication Society Version, JPS Version, says, let him champion the lowly among the people, deliver the needy folk. Not the children of the needy folk, but deliver the needy folk and crush those who wrong them. So I'm inclined to take this as another illustration of that use of Ben, son, member of a group. I have one other reference I want to give you. I don't have it on the slide here. It's 2 Chronicles 25:13. There you read, reading from the NIV, meanwhile the troops that Amaziah had sent back and had not allowed to take part in the war raided Judean towns from Samaria to Bethor. The translation troops, if you look at the Hebrew there, it's U B'nei Hagadun. It's the sons of the troop, or the sons of the band or troop, Gedun. Now, I don't think that Amaziah sent your children or sons of the soldiers back. He sent the troops back. People that were in that category, identified with that group. So, there are a fair number of examples of that kind of a use of son. And I think then by analogy, when you come across this expression, sons of the prophets, B'nai HaNevi'im, that we should understand the reference to be to those people who belong to the category or class of people known as prophets. Not children of prophets, they are prophets, but they're identified with a group of prophets. And it's for that reason, often the NIV, when it comes to that expression, sons of the prophets, it's translates it as a company of prophets. Yes?
You're saying that the verse, the start of verse 13, the ESV, it says, but the men of the army.
All right.
That should be son, it's sons in
Hebrew. You go to Hebrew, it is U'b'nei Hagadun. No. For the men of the army, they've really taken this understanding, member of the group, as the way that son is used for them. All right, let's go on to three. The term or expression, school of the prophets. We're talking now about these groups of prophets. And it used to be advocated, much more so than it is today, although the idea is still around today, that the groups of prophets should be understood as something like an educational institution, where you had this group of people who were identified as prophets come to be taught various subjects, probably in connection with understanding the law and how that should be interpreted and propagated, so that people could be instructed by one of the great teachers, like Samuel or Elijah or Elisha, and then go out and teach other people what they had learned. And so you had a school of the prophets. That's a very old idea in connection with these groups of the prophets. It appears in the Targums, which were Aramaic translations that were more paraphrases than translations of the Hebrew of the Old Testament. But I don't think there's any really clear basis or evidence for it, that these groups were some sort of educational kind of situation. The term itself, school of the prophets, is not a biblical expression. It occurs nowhere in the Old Testament. And I don't think there's anything to indicate that prophets receive some kind of special training or education in order to perform their task or function. Certainly, that's true with respect to the great writing prophets or canonical prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Amos, etc. We never read of any kind of special instruction or education being necessary in order for those great prophets to perform their gifts. It seems much more the case that these were people who were called out of their normal work by God. Amos was a herdsman, a gatherer of sycamore trees, pulled out of that normal profession and commissioned by the Lord to give his message to the people. And as we noted last week, the Lord said, I will put my word in your mouth. You go proclaim all that I give you to say to the people. Now, I think the closest you can get to some sort of evidence for the companies of prophets to have been some kind of an educational grouping is 1 Samuel 19:20 and 2 Kings 4:38. 1 Samuel 19:20 is the passage where Saul sent his messengers to try to capture David when he had taken refuge with Samuel in a place called Naioth of Ramah. And in verse 20, it says, when they saw a group of prophets prophesying with Samuel standing there as their leader, the Spirit of God came upon Saul's men, and they prophesied also. You remember we talked about that passage last week. What's the meaning of the word prophesy? It seems like some kind of abnormal behavior. The Holy Spirit came on those men. They were unable to capture David. But in the context of that situation, it says Samuel was standing as their leader. And then you wonder, what exactly does that mean? What was Samuel doing? Was he instructing? Well, perhaps. Doesn't say so. It's hard to know without further information. 2 Kings 4:38, you have that with Elisha. In 2 Kings 4:38, you read, Elisha returned to Gilgal, and there was a famine in that region while the company of the prophets was meeting with him. I'm quite sure company there is B'nai and everything. He said to his servant, put on the large pot, cook some stew for these men. It appears that Elisha is the leader there. He's giving a command. He is providing food for the larger group. But again, it doesn't say anything about instruction. So Elisha acts as a leader. Samuel stands as a leader. But it's hard to know how much to make of that and exactly what that function was. I don't think the prophets themselves, whether Samuel or Elisha or even these companies of prophets, are some ancient equivalent to present-day seminary students who need a theological education in order to perform the test. The prophets were people who received their message directly from God and proclaimed it to the people. So those comments about the school of the prophets, or the companies of the prophets, apparently lived in their own communities. We noted last week there were groups of prophets at various places in those earliest early chapters of 2 Kings, in Bethel, in Jericho, in Gilgal. If you go back to 1 Samuel, in 1 Samuel 10, when Saul encountered that company of prophets with the musical instruments who were prophesying, and he became as one of them, he prophesied. That's at Gibeah. And then 1 Samuel 19, we just looked at a minute ago, Naioth and Ramah. Ramah, there was a company of prophets. So you get these companies scattered around in different localities. And some have suggested that they lived communally in some sort of a cloister or abbey, much like a monastery of much later times. And evidence for that, again, is meager, but 2 Kings 4:38 says that they ate together. Now that's that passage we looked at just a minute ago. Elisha returned to Gilgal. There was a famine in that region. While the company of the prophets was meeting with him, he said to his servant, "Put on the large pot, cook some stew for these men." And they were given food there by Elisha, and it seems like they were eating together. However, this is a time of famine. That doesn't necessarily mean that was a customary way in which they ate. The other reference that sometimes appealed to for communal housing is 2 Kings 6:2. You read the company of the prophets, 6:1, said to Elisha, "Look, the place where we meet with you is too small for us. Let us go to the Jordan, where each of us can get a pole, and let us build a place there for us to live." Now, if you look at the Hebrew of that, you take that last phrase, "V'nachasheh lanu sham makom," and let us make for us there makom, a place. Sham, there. A place, makom, lasheveh sham. Lasheveh, yashav. Yashav can mean to sit or to dwell. Is that a place to sit and to gather, or is it a place to dwell, a house of some sort? I think you could understand this, the term place, as a place where various dwellings could be built, not necessarily one dwelling. But the phrase could also be translated a place for us to sit, some sort of assembly hall. You see, the preceding verse has said, "Look, the place where we meet with you is too small for us." So again, I don't think this is a reference that establishes incontrovertibly that this is a communal dwelling of some sort. If you go to 2 Kings 4, a few chapters earlier, it seems like these members of the company of the prophets had their own separate dwelling places rather than one communal dwelling place. In 2 Kings 4, 1-7, you have that story of the wife of a member of the company of the prophets called on Elisha, said, "My husband is dead, and his creditor is coming to take my two boys as his slaves." She had debts to pay and nothing to pay the debt with. So in 4:2, Elisha says, how can I help you? Tell me what you have in your house. Sounds like she had her own dwelling place. What do you have in your house? Your servant has nothing there at all, she said, except a little oil. Elisha said, go around and ask all your neighbors for empty jars. Don't ask for just you. Then go inside, shut the door behind you and your sons, pour into all the jars as each is filled, put on one side, and so forth. And she does that. Of course, these jars are filled. She sells them. She's able to pay the debt. But the point of bringing that up is here, it doesn't look like communal living for this wife of one of the members of the group or company of prophets. It seems like she may have lived in a prophetic neighborhood of some sort, but had her own house. And I think that fits with a kind of incidental feature of 1 Samuel 19. If you go back to that passage, that's Naioth and Ramah. That expression, Naioth and Ramah, you see in verse 19 of 1 Samuel 19, word came to Saul, David is in Naioth at Ramah. Well, Ramah is a city. What's Naioth in Ramah? The Hebrew word Naweh, Nun, Wow, Hey, Naweh, means habitation or dwelling. Naioth appears to be a plural form of that. You get that oath ending. So it's possible that Naioth means habitations, plural. And if that's the way to understand Naioth, I think you could understand it as a neighborhood, you might say, of Ramah, where there was a complex of houses that these prophets lived in, the members of the group or company of prophets. So Samuel brought David to that section of town in Ramah where the members of the company of prophets had their dwelling places, but that would be plural, it would be a singular communal dwelling. So, number four, companies of the prophets apparently live in their own communities. And I think that's to be preferred about the idea they had some sort of abbey or cloister. Number five, the degeneration of the prophetic function within the companies. When you read references to these companies of prophets, it seems like, over time, a degeneration set in. This is reading between the lines. We don't know a whole lot about these companies. But it's possible that over time, people began to associate with the companies for material advantage. In other words, for what benefits they might derive from that. We read in 2 Kings 4:42 of that company that we've looked at a couple times. In 4:42, Elijah receives food for the company that was given for their sustenance. A man came from Baal Shalisha, bringing the man of God 20 loaves of barley bread, baked from the first ripe grain, along with some heads of new grain. Give it to the people to eat. The people here are the company of the prophets. How can I set this? 400 men as servant asked. Elisha answered, give it to the people to eat, for this is what the Lord says. They will eat and have some left over. It's kind of like a feeding of the 5,000 of Jesus, but here on a smaller scale, but a multiplication of food for the benefit of these members of the company of the prophets. And it's quite possible that the groups of prophets lived from gifts of that sort. As you go further in the Old Testament, you find that a number of the kings had groups of prophets associated with the court on which they would fall, particularly if they wanted a favorable message. In other words, these were not necessarily true prophets. They were people who presented themselves as prophets, but who spoke what the king wanted to hear. Ahab had prophets of that sort associated with his court. If you look at 1 Kings 22:6, when Ahab had asked Jehoshaphat to join him against fighting, join him in fighting against Ramoth Gilead. Notice, go back to verse 4. Jehoshaphat replied to the king of Israel, "I am as you are, my people is your people, my horses is your horses." But Jehoshaphat also said to the king of Israel, "First seek the counsel of the Lord." So what's Ahab do? King of Israel brought together the prophets, about 400 men, and asked them, "Shall I go to war against Ramoth Gilead, or shall I refrain?" "Go," they answered, "for the Lord will give it into the king's hand." That's what they assumed Ahab wanted them to say, to encourage Jehoshaphat to go with them. But what's Jehoshaphat's response? Jehoshaphat said, "Is there not a prophet of the Lord here, whom we can inquire of?" In other words, he did not believe that these people were speaking for the Lord. And Ahab says, "There's still one man through whom we can inquire of the Lord, but I hate him because he never prophesies anything good about me, always bad. He is Micaiah, son of Imla." My point here, just in calling your attention to this, is that there were companies of prophets associated with the courts of the kings and not always speaking the word of the Lord. If you look at Micah 3:5, Micah says, "As for the prophets who lead my people astray, if one feeds them, they proclaim peace. If he does not, they prepare to wage war against him." In other words, you know the hand that feeds you, and you say what you think that person wants to hear rather than proclaiming the word from the Lord. So it seems like among the groups of the prophets, gradually deterioration set in. Number 6. The canonical prophets are distinguished from these companies. I don't think there's any evidence that any of the writing prophets who produced one of the prophetic books that's contained in the canon of the Old Testament. So, the canonical prophets, I don't think there's any evidence that any of them belong to a company or a guild of prophets. And we also don't read of any of the canonical prophets receiving money or support or livelihood from performing the prophetic task. And there's one text where it seems like one of the canonical prophets explicitly rejects the idea that he should be considered a part of a prophetic group. And that is Amos in Amos chapter 7, verse 14, where Amos says, "I was neither a prophet nor a prophet's son And we see the question is, what's he mean by prophet songwriter? Does he mean member of a group? I think it's quite possible he does, given the use of that expression so many times. It seems like he's saying, I'm not a prophet, or I was not a prophet, nor a prophet's son, but I was a shepherd. Now, I want to look at this in a little bit more detail. And to do that, I think we need to go back and get the whole context. Amos had gone up from Judah to the northern kingdom, to the city of Bethel. Remember, going back to Jeroboam the first, right after the division of the kingdom, Jeroboam the first had established altars at Bethel and there. Bethel, at that time, a man of God out of Judah, 1 Kings 13, went up and cried out against that altar at Bethel. Well, now, under much later time, under Jeroboam the second, Amos does the same thing. And he goes to the Bethel, and Amaziah, you read in verse 10, the priest of Bethel sent a message to Jeroboam, king of Israel, Amos is raising a conspiracy against you in the very heart of Israel. The land cannot bear all his words, for this is what Amos is saying. Jeroboam will die by the sword. Israel will surely go into exile. It's not something Jeroboam wanted to hear. Away from their native land. Then Amaziah said to Amos, get out, you seer. Go back to the land of Judah. And then this next phrase, which I think is significant, an important part of the context. Earn your bread there and do your prophesying there. See, he puts a connection between prophesying and livelihood. Earn your bread there and do your prophesying there, as if the two were connected. Don't prophesy anymore at Bethel, because this is the king's sanctuary and the temple of the kingdom. And that's what Amos responds to. He says to Amaziah, I was neither a prophet nor a prophet's son, but I was a shepherd, and I took care of sycamore fig trees. Now, that raises a translation question. And the question has to do with what is Amos saying here, and how are we to understand what he is saying, which brings up an ambiguity in the Hebrew text. There's no verb there. You see, Amos, Amos answered, and he said unto Amaziah, Lo Navi Anohi, literally, not prophet I. Lo Navi Anohi. With Lo Ben Navi Anohi. Not prophet I, and not son of a prophet I. Now, if you look at translations of that, you have to supply the verb to be. Do you supply the verb to be in the present tense or the past tense? If you see there to the right, New American Standard, it's present tense. I am no prophet, neither am I a prophet's son, but I am a herdsman and a gatherer of sycamore fruit. But if you look at the King James, the NIV, they translate past tense with the verb to be, which has to be supplied. I was no prophet, neither was I a prophet's son, but I was a herdsman, a gatherer of sycamore fruit. The Berkeley gets both there. I am neither a prophet nor the son of a prophet, but I was a herdsman and a grower of sycamore fruit. Now, what's the difference? What's the difference in meaning in what Amos is saying if you translate it with the present tense or the past tense? That may appear to be inconsequential, and what difference is that? I think it makes a significant difference in meaning. Those who suggest a past tense, like King James NIV, understand Amos to be saying, he has not made himself a prophet, but God called him to the text. I was not a prophet. I wasn't a prophet's son. I was a herdsman. And then you go down to verse 15, but the Lord took me from tending the flock, and the Lord said to me, go prophesy. So I wasn't a prophet, but the Lord called me, and I became a prophet. That's basically what he says. So Amos is not denying he's a prophet. He's only saying, I wasn't that originally. Originally, I was a farmer. But if you translate it present tense, that puts a different meaning on what Amos is saying. Remember, Amos is really responding to that statement of the priest in verse 12, earn your bread there, go back to the land of Judah, earn your bread there, be your prophet. And that, Amos is indignant at that. And he's responding to that. And if you translate it in the present tense sense, I am not a prophet, I am not a prophet's son, I think then what Amos is saying to Amaziah is, I am not a prophet in the sense that you understand. That is, I am not a prophet in the sense that I am somebody who prophesies in order to earn my livelihood. As far as Amaziah is concerned, that's what a prophet is. Somebody who's in it for what he can get from it. But Amos responds, I think, by saying, I am not that kind of a, quote, prophet. And I am not the son of a prophet. I'm not the member of one of these prophetic companies. Because I don't need to do that for my livelihood. I am a herdsman. I'm a gatherer or grower of sycamore figs. I sustain myself. I don't prophesy for material advantage. But the Lord came to me and said, go take this message up there. Go prophesy. Now, if you translate it then in that present tense sense, I think what is going on here is Amaziah has made this statement that clearly presupposes that a prophet's in the business for money. Go back to the land of Judah, earn your bread there. Do your prophecy. And Amos responds, I'm not that. I'm a herdsman. I don't need to earn my living by prophecy. I don't prophesy for monetary gain. Now, if that's the way to read this, it suggests a couple things. I think it suggests that in those days, prophesying had come to be understood as a certain type of profession or livelihood. Seems to me that's what Amaziah understood that. And secondly, I think it's suggesting that Amos wanted to make it very clear, I'm not that kind of a prophet. Amos is not denying he's a prophet in the proper sense of the word, but what he is saying is, I have nothing to do with the prophets with which both he and Amaziah were familiar, these kinds of people that prophesied what the king or somebody else wanted to hear in order to get whatever benefit could be derived from that. The NIV here takes the past tense. There's a what's called a TNIV out now. Any of you familiar with that? That is a revision of the NIV. And it still is past. But the TNIV reads, I was neither a prophet nor the disciple of a prophet. In other words, I was neither a prophet nor the son of a prophet, a prophet's son. It now says I was neither a prophet nor the disciple of a prophet, but I was a shepherd. And I took care of sick and sick Jews. So they're still in the past tense with the TNIV. The Jewish Publication Society version is present tense. It's like the NASB, and I think that's being preferred. It says, I am not a prophet, and I am not a prophet's disciple. They use that same expression, prophet's disciple. I am a cattle breeder. Have any of you ever come across the Oxford University Press Jewish Study Bible? There's a Jewish Study Bible, much like the NIV Study Bible, but from a Jewish perspective, published by Oxford Press. The note in the Jewish Study Bible, which uses the Jewish Publication Society version for the translation, says, Amos maintains he is not a professional prophet who may be hired for his services and thus bought. Now, I think they got it right. Amos maintains in verse 12, when he says, I am not a prophet nor the son of a prophet. He maintains he is not a professional prophet who may be hired for his services and thus bought. So, the canonical prophets are distinguished from these companies. You have no reference to any of the canonical prophets being a part of one of these companies, and it seems to me that Amos is making it explicit. He does not want to be identified with the company of the prophets or with the kind of prophet who is in the prophetic group. Any question? Let's go on to you. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah,
it seems like, again, with both Elijah, and Samuel, or with all of them, it seems like Samuel, Elisha, and Elijah were leaders of companies. So whether you make them part of the company, it seems to me the companies were some sort of group of Jewish Publication Society's disciples. Maybe that's a good term. I think that you would look at Samuel, Elisha, and Elijah, though, as above the company, rather than part of it.
So it started that way, but then there was those change. Seems like you're saying that the writing prophets were all single, but all of them, from beginning to end, were not, they didn't even have a profession.
A profession in the sense of earning a livelihood from. Yeah. And, you know, some people like to use the expression office of prophet. I try to avoid it. I prefer the expression the prophetic function, because it seems to me that, I mean, a priest had an office, a king had an office. He, you know, a king was a king, he was anointed to be that, and he was the king, and he had official roles and duties. Priests had official roles and duties. It seems that these prophets did something more sporadically. When the Spirit came on them, they spoke. And so they performed that prophetic function. But I'm not sure I want to call it an office, as if this was all that they ever did. We get back to that thing of the prophets themselves knowing in their own heart and mind when they were speaking the word of the Lord as compared to their own word. You know, somebody like Nathan, who was a prophet frequently to David, where he gave him the Lord's message, was to ask for his opinion on building the temple, and he gave his personal opinion, and it was wrong. When they worked for the Lord, he had to go back and correct it. So every word they spoke was not an inspired word. That help with your question? I kind of get all distracted.
Oh,
yeah. All right, Jean. The canonical prophets are writing prophets. I just want to make a couple comments here on the labels. Both of these labels you'll find in the literature. Writing prophets is a designation for those prophets who have given us a writing bearing their name in the Old Testament canon. In other words, the writing prophets are the four major and 12 minor prophets of the canon of the Old Testament. So in that sense, writing prophets and canonical prophets are synonymous. You're referring to the same people. I think those labels are useful, but they can be misunderstood. With respect to writing prophets, we know that there were prophets who wrote whose writings have not been preserved for us in the canon of Scripture. In other words, if you really want to push it, the expression writing prophets is larger than the canonical prophets. Chronicles speaks of the writing of a number of individuals whose writings were termed prophets, whose writings have not been preserved for us and included in the canon. Look at a couple references. 2 Chronicles 9:29. Where do you read, as for the other events of Solomon's reign from beginning to end, are they not written in the records of Nathan the prophet, in the prophecy of Ahijah the Shilonite, and in the visions of Iddo the seer? So there's Nathan, Ahijah, and Iddo, who wrote, and wrote as prophets of God. But those writings, for whatever reason, were not preserved and included in the canon of the Old Testament. There are some other references, 2 Chronicles 13:22 and 21:12. I won't take the time to look at them. And I think you can also say that even the term canonical prophets also is somewhat deficient, because it separates the prophetic books from the historical books. In Jewish tradition, we don't have that separation between the prophetic books and the historical books. In Jewish tradition, we have reference to what is called the former prophets and the latter prophets. The former prophets are what we call the historical books, Joshua, Judges, and the Kings. Those are the former prophets. The latter prophets are what we call the prophetic books. So, I think the Jewish tradition is much more accurate. All of those books are prophetic books. Historical books are a divinely inspired record and interpretation of what was going on with God's people in the Old Testament period. And they are prophetic just as much as what we call the prophetic books. So, just those comments on those two labels. Any questions or comments?
So would Elisha and Elijah be considered canonical prophets?
No, because they don't have a book in the canon of Scripture that bears their name. They wouldn't be canonical prophets or writing prophets, either one. Yeah.
The former prophets, you said, how would they categorize the former and later prophets?
The former prophets are what we call the historical books, Joshua, Jezreel, Samuel, Samuel.
endures to virtue.
And the latter prophets are the four major and fourth one. All right, let's go on to Romans 2, the prophetic nomenclature. I want to go down through some of the words and phrases used in the Old Testament to designate the prophets. And I think through looking at the nomenclature, we get some insight into the nature of the prophetic function. And I think from the outset, let me make this comment. I think most people, when they hear the word prophet, immediately think that there were those, there was this group of people in the Old Testament who foretold the future. In other words, a prophet is someone who predicts the future. And I think that really misses the point. Yes, it's true that in many of the prophetic books, we do have predictions about things that will come to pass in the future. But that was not the essence of what it meant to be a prophet, predicting the future. The prophets were basically preachers. And they spoke to the needs of God's people in the Old Testament period. And much of what they had to say was a call to repentance, a call to return to the covenant, a call to be obedient to the Lord, to put away false worship. So the essence of prophetic ministry lies elsewhere than in prediction. The two are not synonymous. To be a prophet is not necessarily to always tell about what will happen in the future. And I think that comes out in some of the nomenclature with which the prophets are identified. A under 2 is the most general name, is man of God. That expression is used 76 times in the Old Testament. About half of them are used in connection with Elisha, who's often just termed the man of God. There are a number in 1 Kings 13 where you have that man of God out of Judah that went up and prophesied against the altar of Jeroboam the first. But a lot of the others are widely scattered. Moses is called a man of God, Samuel is, Elijah is, Shemaiah is. So, widely used. And what it suggests is, the prophet is a person who stands in a relationship with God. You're a man of God, you are in some sort of relationship with God. Exactly what relationship is not defined. But here are people who are men of God. B is servant of the Lord. My servants, the prophets, we talked about that last week. Here the relationship is more clearly indicated. These prophets were servants of God. The relationship is one of service. But again, that's still rather general. It's used of many of the prophets, but it's also used more widely because people other than prophets are called servants of God. One interesting reference is to King Nebuchadnezzar in Jeremiah 27:6 and 43:10. He is called a servant of the Lord. He wasn't a prophet. He wasn't even a believing child of God. But he was an instrument in the hand of God to accomplish God's purposes and plans in connection with the punishment that was coming on Judah. So he's called a servant of the Lord. Yes.
What's the chapter?
Jeremiah 27:6 and 43:10. C is the messenger of the Lord. Now here you get more explicit. The prophet is a person who brings the message of God to men. And you might think that would be used extensively because that is the essence of what the prophet does. But it's not, interestingly enough. It's very infrequent. It's used only of Haggai. Haggai 1:13. Which says, Haggai, the Lord's messenger, gave this message of the Lord to the people. The message followed. I say it's used only of Haggai. That is, it's used only of Haggai unless you take Malachi 1:1, where it says, an oracle, the word of the Lord to Israel through Malachi. But if you look at that in Hebrew, it is an oracle, the word of the Lord to Israel through Malachi. Malachi, if you translate it, is my messenger. And there are some people who think we don't know the name of this prophet, that that is just a generic designation of a messenger for the Lord. An oracle, the word of the Lord to Israel through Malachi, my messenger. I'm inclined to think it is a proper name because that introductory line is so characteristic of all the prophetic books where you do have the name of the prophet given, or it seems to me it's most likely his name. But that's C, messenger of the Lord. D is the Hebrew word Navi. And that is the word that most often is used to designate the prophet. When you come across the word prophet in your English translations of the Hebrew Old Testament, it is a translation of this word. In the Septuagint, that Hebrew word is translated by the Greek word prophetes. So you see where we get the word prophet. The English word prophet is a derivative of prophetes, which is the Greek Septuagint translation of Navi. So then the question becomes, what does Navi mean? When someone, particularly in the Old Testament period, heard that word, what was the connotation to them of this word? And that brings up a lot of questions where there's a lot of disagreement as far as origin, etymology, and so forth. But I think what is clear is, Navi did not mean some sort of soothsayer, diviner, reader of omens, somebody who did that sort of thing. Prophetes is the Greek translation of Navi. For practice of divination, soothsayer, that sort of thing, Greek used the term mantis. And to practice divination is mantubomai. So, in both the Hebrew of the Old Testament and in the Greek, you have a distinction there between soothsayer, divine, and prophets. In classical Greek literature, prophetes was understood as someone who interpreted the message of the gods to men. place where that becomes particularly clear is in the temple of Apollo at Delphi. There was a priestess who was called the Pythia. And this priestess gave messages from the deity in a frenzied sort of trance while sitting on a golden tripod. So here is this Pythia who gives this kind of unintelligible revelation from the deity Apollo. But then you see what happened was the prophetess came along and interpreted those unintelligible sounds of the Pythia into understandable language. So the prophetess interpreted the disclosures of the gods for the people around the temple. If you look at your citations page 2, down the bottom of the page, there's a paragraph from your favorite writer on Old Testament subjects, Gerhardus Voss, from his Biblical Theology, where he's talking about Navi. And he says, with this entry into the meaning of Navi, we may combine a brief discussion of its Greek equivalent, prophetes, from which our word prophet is come. We associate with this mostly the idea of foretelling, predictor. This is not in accord with the original Greek etymology. The preposition pro in the composition does not express the time sense of beforehand. It has local significance. The prophetes is a foreteller. The Greek term, however, has religious associations no less than the Hebrew one. Prophetes is the one who speaks for the oracle. Thus it might seem that with the pro correctly understood, the Hebrew Navi and the Greek prophetes were practically synonyms. This, however, would be misleading. The Greek prophetes does not stand in the same direct relation to the deity as the Hebrew Navi does. In reality, he is the interpreter of the oracular dark utterances of the Pythia or some other inspired person whom, from the depth underneath, the godhead of the shrine inspires. The Pythia would thus stand at the same remove from the deity as the Navi, but the prophetes is separated from the deity by this intervening person. Prophetes is therefore rather an interpreter than a mouthpiece of what the god speaks through the one he directly inspired. In other words, the Pythia was the one through whom the god spoke, but when God spoke through the Pythia, it was in unintelligible sounds. So the prophetes takes those unintelligible sounds and makes them understandable. So he's the interpreter rather than the mouthpiece. He adds of his own not merely the illumination of the article, but also the form in which he clothes the meaning that perceived. It is no wonder then that the word prophetes, taken into the service of biblical religion, had to undergo a baptism of regeneration before it could be practically reviewed. In other words, what he's saying is, if you were a Greek translator of the Hebrew of the Old Testament, and you're looking for a word to properly represent Navi in Hebrew, you take the Greek word that's closest to that function, and that happens to be the word prophetes, but it has a different background. So when it's brought into use in the biblical context, you have to be aware of that difference. Now, To get back to this word Navi, what does it mean? There's been a lot of discussion about the etymology of Navi.
I think on your outline, if you look, I have two subpoints under D. One is etymology, and two is usage. When you ask the question of etymology, you find very quickly you get into disputes. Some have said Navi, which is Nun Beit Aleph, is a derivative of an Arabic word. Excuse me. At this point, it's a derivative of another Hebrew root, Nun Beit Ayin. Instead of an Aleph, you have an Ayin, a derivative of Nun Beit Ayin, which means to bubble forth. And the suggestion, this was Gesenius, who was a great Hebrew scholar, grammarian. He said the prophet was called by this name because of the impression his speaking made. The flow of words was like they just bubbled forth from the mouth of a prophet. Others see it as derived from an Akkadian root, Nabu. And Nabu in Akkadian means to speak. The word Nabu comes from the Babylonian deity Nebo or Nabu, who was the god of wisdom and science, the god of word and writing. And you get that same component in familiar names like Nebuchadnezzar, Nabopolassar, etc. So if it comes from Nabu, then a Navi would be a speaker. And more specifically, someone who spoke for God. You look at your citations, page 3, under T.J. Meek, in a volume on Hebrew origins, he says, the third word for prophet is the one that has become the most popular of all, almost wholly replaced the older term roeh. I'm going to come back to roeh later. It is Navi, from a root not found in Hebrew, but found in Akkadian as Nabu, to call out, to speak. It accordingly means speaker, spokesman of God, and is correctly translated in the Septuagint by the Greek prophetes. That's a font problem there, but that's prophetes. A noun derived from the preposition pro, for, in behalf of, and the verb phemi, to speak for, on behalf of, pro-fame. Hence, the prophet of the Navi type was strictly not a foreteller, as is popularly supposed, but a foreteller, or preacher. This was the meaning of prophet in English until after the time of Queen Elizabeth, when, for some reason, the term came to be equated with foretelling, predicting. For an example, a book by Jeremy Taylor, published in 1647, entitled The Liberty of Prophesying, is not what the present connotation of words would lead one to think. It is a book on freedom of speech. In modern language, the freedom of preaching. Accordingly, the strict meaning of the word prophet in English and its meaning in the original Greek and Hebrew is speaker, spokesman. And it goes on, discusses that a little bit further. So that's the idea. If it comes from Nabu, it means to speak. There are others who say, yes, it comes from Nabu, but rather than being from the active voice of that Akkadian word, it's a passive form. And then it would have the meaning someone called by God. If you look above that paragraph by Meek on page 3 of your citations, some statements by William Putzwell Albright, in his book Stone Age Christianity. He says the current explanation of the word Navi, prophet, as speaker is almost certainly false. The correct etymological meaning of the word is rather one who is called by God, who has a vocation from God, as appears from the fact that this is almost always the sense in which the verb Navi to call has an occasion, from the middle of the third millennium to the middle of the first. And he discusses that further. He says, down a few lines, the interpretation of the word suits its meaning exactly. The prophet was a man who felt himself called by God for a special mission, which his will was subordinated to the will of God. So, and there are some other viewpoints under etymology. I think the etymology remains uncertain. But these ideas to speak for someone called by God, I think are consistent with what we find in biblical usage. And more important than etymology, the meaning of any word, is its meaning in the context of specific passages, and its meaning is derived from how it's used. So that brings us to two. Let me just get started on that, and that is usage of the word Navi. We did a little bit with the way it was used last week, and I did refer you to Deuteronomy 18:18 as a key verse where the prophetic function is described in very explicit language. And you have in 18:18 of Deuteronomy the statement, I will raise up for them a prophet and not thee, like you, Moses, from among their brothers. I will put my words in his mouth, and he will tell them everything I command them. And as I mentioned last week, that's the same thing that is said in Jeremiah 1:9, where the Lord says, Jeremiah, I will put my words in your mouth. Now, interesting in connection with that is Exodus 7:1. Look at Exodus 7:1. There you read, the Lord said to Moses, see, I have made you like God to Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron will be your Navi. I think that verse gives us some insight into what a prophet is and what the relationship of the prophet is to God. The relationship of Aaron to Moses will be like that of the prophet to God. In other words, Moses will stand in relation to Pharaoh as God does to his people. But Moses will not speak himself to the Pharaoh. That's going to be done by Aaron. Aaron will convey the message of Moses to Pharaoh, just as the prophet conveys the message of God to the people. So, you remember Moses said, I can't speak, and then the Lord had said, Aaron will speak for you. And here it says, I've made you like God the Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron will be with the prophet. If you go to Exodus 4:16, where that discussion took place about Moses speaking, you notice, let me get the background, go back to 4:15. You shall speak to him, put words in his mouth. I will help both of you speak and will teach you what to do. He will speak to the people for you. And it will be, notice, as if he were your mouth. That is Aaron, the Moses. It will be as if he were your mouth, and as if you were God to him. But take this staff in your hand so you can perform miraculous signs with it. Aaron is spoken of as the mouth of Moses. And a prophet is the mouth of God in the analogy. So I think when you get to usage of Navi, those texts give us a pretty clear insight into what the meaning of the word is. The next designation is Roeh in